Ray McDaniel is a non-binary therapist, certified sex therapist, transgender diversity and inclusion educator, speaker, and author of Gender Magic. They are the founder and CEO of Practical Audacity, a gender and sex therapy practice based in Chicago, and an international advocate for gender freedom. We are thrilled to welcome Ray to the show today.
Hello.
Welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm doing great. I just got back from a trip to do a book event in Seattle and then immediately got strep throat, but I'm feeling like a human.
Oh, no. Thanks, Seattle, for nothing. Just kidding. I'm sure it was a lovely city.
It was.
And so you're based in Chicago normally?
I am. Yep.
Awesome. And what are your pronouns?
They, them.
Cool. She, her. And, you know, one of our anchor questions, and it's one of the reasons I'm very thrilled to talk to you today, is what is your experience of gender today?
Ooh, such a good question. How deep do we want to go with this particular one?
It's a long form podcast, baby. Let's fucking go.
Great. Cool. So I'm a non-binary person. I use they, them pronouns. I have had top surgery. I got that actually on my birthday a few years ago during the pandemic.
The most painful, euphoric birthday present possible.
Exactly. And I've been on and off of testosterone over the past probably 5 years. So if we want to go way back, I did not grow up knowing that I was trans or non-binary or even queer. I grew up in a very, very conservative household. So it didn't even dawn on me that it was an option until probably late college, early grad school. But whenever it did dawn on me that being queer was an option, it very much felt like I describe it in Gender Magic as putting on a shoe that was finally the right size instead of half a size too small, where I, you know, if you have a shoe that's a little bit too small, you can walk around in it for a while. It's like fine until those blisters start to develop. Yeah. And suddenly that is all that you can think about. And that was my experience. And putting on a non-binary identity very much felt like I finally fit in my own skin.
Wow. So like hugely affirming. And you said Absolutely. That was around like college and grad school. So, and I mean, I wonder, and we can kind of figure this out, like one of the later questions in the show is traditionally like, what were the first messages you received around sex and sexuality? And this seems like it's kind of woven into your gender journey. So I wonder maybe if can also touch on that, but we can also like wait, because I know that's a kind of intense, it can be an intense one to start with.
I'm happy to start there.
Cool.
I have such an interesting background with sex and sexuality. So like I said, I grew up in a very, very conservative household. There's a whole story there, but my parents are or were evangelical Southern Baptist missionaries.
Wow.
And so we traveled full time when I was a teenager, and they just retired from doing that work after about 20 years, fairly recently. So my experience with sex and sexuality growing up was that we didn't talk about it. It didn't exist. It was actively discouraged.
So
anything to do with my body or sexuality was just not a thing.
Were you like within kind of purity culture, or was that something separate, or kind of like, was it a very loud message of like, your body's for God and marriage, or was it like, How was
super loud, super, super loud. So I think I remember reading the infamous I Kiss Dating Goodbye book when I was probably 12 or 13. So it was such a formative message and this really strange cultural moment in evangelical Christianity around purity culture, purity rings, like you don't do anything before marriage. And that I kind of got into that on my own, but that was very much reaffirmed by my parents and even in how thrilled. I dressed. Oh, they were so happy.
Like, oh, you love like, abstinence. Thank God. Right.
Exactly. Yeah, for real. Very much the message of like, your body is for God. Sexuality is bad until you're married. And then that's for your husband. And yeah, I know that face. Oof. Exactly.
Sorry for listeners. As it is an audio podcast, it's like, I'm just kind of pull like frown and then pull your bottom lip away from your teeth. That's the face I'm making.
That's the one. Yes.
Okay. So this was a very kind of like, there was a lot of messages and none of them were positive.
Yeah, exactly. Lots and lots of messages, including the really fun one around like, if you lose your virginity, especially as someone who is assigned female at birth, you're like a used piece of gum or rose that has the petals picked off and you wouldn't want to give that to somebody else. It was really intense, actually. Yeah.
And so sad. Like, what so a message sad. To receive about one's body.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yes, absolutely. And so that played into I was in a relationship starting when I was about 15 with this guy who, looking back, there's a reason that we were drawn together, but it wasn't because we were meant to be together forever. We were best friends. He was one of the most progressive people in that area that I met. And so we really connected. We ended up getting married when I was 18 because that's what you do when you're in evangelical Christianity and you can't touch each other. So we got married and I very, very quickly discovered that I had a very painful pelvic pain disorder that there's no known origin. And I kind of sat with it for a long time before I even went to a doctor and eventually a therapist about it. And it complicated everything about my relationship to sex and sexuality because it became so intertwined with pain.
Yeah.
And so then it was very difficult to pull apart which parts of this are pain in my body and which parts of this are a budding queerness.
Yeah.
And so it took several years for me to address that physically as well as emotionally and pull those things apart for myself.
Yeah. I mean, and imaginally also like, because all of the messages you'd received around sex and sexuality were kind of, and, you know, in fact, like gender and queerness that were all kind of negative or against, I guess, not your authentic self. That your body is, of course, like, no, thank you.
Like, it tracks.
I mean, it definitely tracks. And as you know, apparently problematic Bessel van der Kolk says, the body does indeed keep the score.
Yes, it does.
And so kind of how did it unfold from there?
So I went to Chicago for graduate school. I was still married at the time. But basically, as soon as I got to Chicago, I felt like I could breathe really for the first time. Within a few months, I had moved out of the house with my husband and started immediately exploring my queerness, which I think I was the one who was most surprised by that out of anybody in my life. Including my college friends who are all the like gay theater kids, right?
Who was like, we know.
Yeah. Literally, I came out to one of my friends from college and their response was, I thought you were already out.
We just like didn't talk about it because we assumed that you knew this. I mean, but and how did you kind of like, what did that transition feel like just kind of into this, like this phase of yourself, like finding this out about yourself? Like, how did you kind of pivot from like having an entirely evangelical upbringing and being, you know, wed at 18 to going to grad school and being like, actually, I released this. Like, how did you do that?
Well, I think I had started moving away from the church when I was probably about midway through my sophomore year of college and was pretty much a full-blown heathen in junior and senior year. So that part I had already started pulling apart several years earlier. And when I moved away from my marriage and let that go, that was for many reasons, some of them related to my queerness and some of them not. It felt very gentle, which I feel very privileged to be able to say. Yeah. You know, my best friends from college were already the gay kids. I was living with a trans person already. I was wanting my career in therapy to move towards supporting the LGBTQ population. So I was already developing that community as I was discovering more about myself. And I feel very lucky and very privileged to have been in that environment to do that discovery. That said, I had no idea what I was fucking doing. So it was messy for a few years of trying to understand myself, trying to understand both my queerness and my relational orientation as a polyamorous person and figuring out what that meant. And so there were so many beautiful moments of discoveries and also so many moments where I'm like, wow, I was a mess.
Yeah. I mean, I imagine like just the level of kind of disorientation to have all that going on at the same time must have been a lot.
Oh yeah. It was definitely a lot, but luckily kind of found my way through it over a period of many years, focusing a lot on building that community and getting to know the queer community in Chicago and really developing that chosen family and slowly figuring out what I wanted my relationships to look like, what I wanted my sexuality to feel like and look like, and feeling more free in that the more that I discovered. And then eventually doing the same thing with gender, which again was also a very gentle kind of, oh, this makes sense.
Oh, awesome. I mean, and I'm curious because it also sounds like it kind of paralleled your career trajectory. And I'm assuming that your master's was in psychotherapy and that you kind of followed this into kind of a more like queer oriented and also like sex and sexuality based practice. Like, was what you were learning at the time kind of paralleled by your life? You're like, as the doors kind of open progressively, you're like, oh, actually this tracks too. Like, what was that like to kind of be learning in real time and like living into yourself in an authentic way?
Yeah. I don't know if this is because I have a million placements in Capricorn on my astrological chart or not, but oh, you resonate.
Oh, yeah.
But it's been interesting in my life. My work has always definitely paralleled and often been a few steps before my personal development. So I had decided even before I came out as queer that I wanted to work with the LGBTQ population and be a therapist with that population.
What? I mean, it's funny because like what made you decide that? It was like, I love the queers.
I mean, yeah, that was a big part of it. It was a really big part of it. But my best friends in college were the theater kids. And I was at this super tiny, very evangelical college in the woods of East Texas. And I watched my friends who were also discovering their identity and coming out and figuring out relationships and disclosures to family and navigating being in such an oppressive environment. And I saw how much they struggled with it. And I was falling in love with psychology at the same time. And I realized like, oh, I want to help people like my friends. I want to help my friends do this better and easier because I see how painful this is.
And have some support, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's where it came from. No surprise that it ended up being a huge part of my identity as well. So I was learning a lot about myself in parallel with taking these college courses in women and gender studies and figuring out more about the LGBTQ population in psychology. And it has always been this like parallel process for me, trying to think what are the big moments here that I want to highlight. Oh, the sex and sexuality. So as I was getting into working with the LGBTQ population, I was out, I was figuring stuff out. I also started hearing a lot about sex from my clients. And especially with trans folks, every single person that I met with talked to me at some point about sex and relationships. And I realized that I knew some and I was already interested in the topic, but I didn't have all the tools that I needed to support them. So I went back to school with a distance program at the University of Michigan to get my sex therapy certification. Because again, I wanted to help my clients more. But given my history with a pelvic pain disorder, given some intergenerational trauma in my family and my own experiences trying to figure out my sexuality along with my queerness, along with polyamory and kink and all of these things, it dovetailed really nicely into what became my specialization.
Awesome. Well, I mean, it also sounds like, you know, again, the podcast is called Sober Sex. We talk a lot about recovery here. And I think that like the main message of especially kind of 12-step oriented recovery is like the wounded healer, is that like we are the most effective at helping people who suffer from what we have suffered and healed from. And it sounds like this also kind of tracks with your story and your kind of, like becoming, essentially.
Yeah, it absolutely does. And it within the sex therapy and sex education field, there are a lot of people who get into that field who I've heard some of them describe it as a orientation toward mega sexual. Like they really love sex and their libidos are really high and they're so excited to talk about that. I came to it from a very different place, like you're saying, of my relationship with sex was not good. I had very intense pain with sex that I had to move through. I had very intense experiences of homophobia that I needed to move through. And that, I think, brings me to the work in a slightly different way than some of the other folks in this kind of wounded healer and healing and helping folks through that kind of vibe.
For sure. I mean, and so, you know, I guess now we circle back to the original question, which is kind of about like how, what is your experience of gender today? And, or I guess more, how did that part of the journey start for you?
Like I've said, it was very, very gentle. So there wasn't one moment that I was like, oh, I'm trans. It wasn't a light bulb. It was these tiny moments of starting to feel constricted in my assigned gender of female, starting to feel like it was a little bit too small for me, starting to notice and be curious about what I was drawn to in terms of other people's aesthetic, in terms of the people that I found myself very interested in getting to know, because there was something about them that resonated with me. And I think over time, I started playing with, well, is my given name a name that truly feels like it fits for me? And turns out it wasn't. And I started asking some close friends to use Ray as my name, which is a whole other story, but it does, there is a connection to that name that is pretty special to me. But I remember a girlfriend at the time, we had talked about it, and I hadn't told hardly anybody, maybe like a couple people, that I wanted to play with Ray as a name. And we were laying on the couch and I was like leaning against her and she whispered Ray in my ear. And it was just this moment of like full body shivers when I was like, okay.
Yeah, that this is the right thing.
This is the right thing. Yeah. And I think kind of similar things with using they, them pronouns. Of I started at first going by she and they, and the expansiveness of having the people she, they use they. Yes, I know. And you know, no knocking anybody who uses both pronouns, like absolutely. And for me, it was a stepping stone. And eventually it was like, you know what? I start feeling a little twingy when people use she, her. Like, that's a clue. And yeah. It was this building on one tiny step at a time, which is also what I teach in gender magic of what do you know for sure? What makes you light up? What sends those shivers down your spine? And how do you get more of that? And how do you start experimenting to even see what causes that reaction? And it was one tiny building block after another.
I mean, that's so, I feel very emotional when you talk about that, because I think a kind of main message of the book is that we hear so much about kind of like trans lives being in danger and like the existence of the genders existing without the binary being kind of trying to be snuffed out, you know, politically and socially, especially in the US right now. And like, I'm so moved by how much like energy and joy and curiosity, like it's A, that the book is about, and of course we'll get into that, but B, that like, again, this word kind of becoming continues to pop up, and it's like living authentically. And also, as you said, like, it sounds like you were learning actively, kind of like, this was me, maybe never, but this like being recognized for who you actually are, and then like able to kind of live into that and be supported in that identity is like such a beautiful and powerful thing. So like, thank you for talking to us about it. And I'm curious also, like, do you feel like you found like a nesting place, or do you feel like when we use this idea of like a prefix of trans, do you feel like that is actually like, it continues to be a transitional space where like it's a shifting landscape, or like, where are you at?
Yeah. I view gender transition and gender exploration as very much a part of self-growth and self-actualization. And what I mean by that is that I don't ever think, for me, and I think for the majority of people that I work with, that there is a point B where we land in who we are and we never change.
Yeah, the destination is a myth.
Yeah, the destination is absolutely a myth. And that is a good thing. That's not meant to be a striving or a stressful thing, but an acknowledgement that we are always becoming more of who we authentically are. Like, was I authentically myself, you know, 2 years ago? Yes, to the best of my ability at the time. And now I am who I am authentically in a different way to the best of my ability right now. And I hope that I will continue to evolve and change into more of who I am throughout my lifetime. And when it comes to gender, I do feel like I'm in a pretty comfy place. At this point, I don't see any sort of huge, major additional changes happening. And I think that how I understand myself, how I understand my gender, how I present myself in the world will continue to grow and change over my lifetime. And I feel very comfortable in that. That isn't stressful to me. In fact, it's pretty exciting that I get to continue to evolve who I am over my lifetime.
Yeah. I mean, it also seems, and I love hearing that too, that it is like, it's the journey is the reward, essentially. Like,
yeah.
And that, how exciting too, to kind of like take, you know, I think that your work speaks a lot to kind of taking the fear out of that process, because I do think that, like, again, we exist in a society, right? And like, it can be very scary to kind of, I don't know, feel out like others' reactions to that level of authenticity and growth. I think like it can be destabilizing for the people around us as we grow into ourselves. And like, it can also be an invitation to liberation, right?
Yep, absolutely. I think often, people think of gender as like gender with a capital G, like gender. Like, it's a huge deal when we grow and change in our gender. And certainly our society has made it a huge deal.
Especially right now.
Especially right now with all of the barriers. Like, yes, it is a big deal in that sense. But I like to zoom out and think about gender again as just another part of self-growth. And if for a moment we pause reality and push aside all of the cultural barriers and systemic barriers that trans people have just for a moment, right? We can't forget about those, but just for a moment. That self-growth of any kind in our life is always going to be destabilizing to those around us. It is always going to shake up family systems, relational systems, our lives when we grow and change into more of who we are. That is not unique to gender.
For sure. I mean, and, again, like the podcast is Sober Sex, and I think there's a lot of parallels in that department, right? But 100%. Like, yeah, we'll get into that later. Anyway, continue. Sorry.
No, that was kind of it. Of if we push aside, hey, culture has made this hard, legal things have made this hard, and just view it as like, yes, we are growing and changing, and that is going to make people uncomfortable, and it's going to destabilize things because change destabilizes without it being about gender as a bad thing, as a destabilizing thing on its own. It's just because it's change.
Yeah, totally. And again, I agree that like growing towards the most authentic versions of ourselves is always like growth is hard, man. You know, it's just like, but you know what, like what's the alternative, right? Like stay stuck or die. Those are kind of those are the alternatives. So
yeah,
like, I mean, I'm excited to kind of discuss like what the tools that you employ and offer in terms of like this path of liberation. And kind of before we get into that, I'm also curious as to kind of how has the book tour, like how has, you know, often like we talk to a lot of authors here, and I feel like often it can go from being in a very kind of introverted place of like creating something to a very extroverted place of presenting and touring and promoting something. And I wonder how that process has been for you, especially because I think it is really powerful work. You know, I'm sure you're getting quite an intense emotional response.
Yeah, it's been really beautiful. So I've been working on this book since January of 2021. So it has been a lot of holding everything in the book and developing the work. And it has been so special to actually have it out in the world and be able to have conversations with people about the content in it. And my heart is often exploding these days. Mm-hmm. You know, people are sending me messages about how gender magic has influenced them, how it has impacted them, what is resonating with them. And so many times in the past, now almost 2 months, I've come to this place of, wow, worth it. Like if I never sell another book, but I do, so buy my book. if I never sell another book, like the impact that has already made is worth it. And that feels really special. And I feel very privileged to be able to share my work in this way that is accessible to so many more people than I could impact with just one-on-one or even group work in my therapy and coaching practice.
Awesome.
So that's been really special. I've been on a lot of podcasts and talking about the content, which has been, again, really fun to actually dig into the content that and figure out what is resonating with people and deepen those conversations. So it's been a blast. Tiring. I feel like I'm on mile 30 of a marathon, but great.
Keep running.
Keep going. I mean,
how do you, and I'm curious as to kind of how you balance like not only like work-life stuff, but also like how you take care of yourself, because it sounds like, you know, that there's kind of a lot of that, like putting the personal, like the private practice and the coaching stuff to the side while you tour the book, or like, how are you kind of organizing your energy? Cause I think that seems like kind of a lot.
It is a lot, and I don't always do it perfectly. Like there have been moments where I just hit a wall and need to stare at a wall for a while. I am very, very lucky, again, that I have a really incredible leadership team at my therapy practice. So they are doing most of the day-to-day running of that practice, and I could not be doing what I'm doing now with writing the book and now promoting the book and touring the book without them. So that is a huge thing, is having a team to support you. Could not do it without them. Beyond that, again, I don't always do this perfectly, but I do try to have pretty strict boundaries around my time. Now, I still, for the most part, take weekends off. I have pretty strict cutoffs in the evening of when I work and when I don't. Have some travel that is upcoming as an actual vacation. Wow. Ooh. Right? So that'll be really fun. And silly things, small things, I should say, of I've really tried to reclaim my first cup of coffee and morning time as mine. And for the first cup of coffee in the morning, I try to read a book that is in no way productive. Some sort of sci-fi or fiction, something. And that has been a nice ritual to help me ease into the day and not immediately fill my brain with work. Little things, like one of my friends got me a adult paint by number thing. So I've been like working on my little paint by number, which has been really cute.
To be here now, like occupying my hands.
Exactly.
It's rad just because I think strategies are important, you know, like when life gets big, it's also important to kind of have little anchors to kind of like cling to along the way.
And I think go ahead.
You go. No.
One of the things that I am learning, which is really interesting, is that we know we have to do self-care when things are hard and intense, but we often don't think about self-care when things are good and intense. But that level of activation in our nervous system is the same. It's just the flip side of the coin. And so I'm learning that I'm having these big highs around the book and the response and a lot of stuff that I'm doing. And I need just as much self-care and downtime from that as I do when things are hard and intense.
No, that's a really good note, actually. I remember, by trade, I'm a musician and a DJ. And like, I DJed a rave cruise like 5 years ago. And because I saw like 20 people I loved in like the first 10 minutes of this experience, like my adrenals were essentially shot for the rest of the trip. I was just like too excited, like a puppy, you know, and I'm just like, I have to go to my room by myself. I feel like I'm crashing so hard. I think also like, again, just so much of like, we're learning actively about this idea of like nervous system regulation, right? It seems like this is kind of not a new concept, but like a trending idea of like a somatic ladder or whatever. And this ability to kind of like actually be able to kind of ride the wave as opposed to like get stuck in like stress zone, whether it's good or bad stress, is such a, like, it's a skill that I think we all could use more of.
Absolutely agree.
And so to pivot a little bit, I refer to my notes here, so that's why I'm not making eye contact. I heard you talk about queering friendship on the wonderful podcast, Let It Out, and the notion of moving away from the idea that monogamous or heteronormative romantic love is like at the top of the relationship hierarchy and everything else is somehow second to that. So like, it's like my person and then everybody else. And it sounds really crucial to communities, obviously, like queer communities, but I think also recovering communities where like... a lot of times people are separated from their family of origin based on kind of that's what a healthy boundary is, or, you know, because alcoholism is a family disease, like a lot of that stuff. And I'm curious about kind of your experience of queering friendship and like, again, how to kind of have a healthy balance in that part of your life.
Yeah. This has been one of the greatest discoveries of my life, I think. And like you're saying, there's a lot of parallels between queer folks and folks in recovery, and especially queer folks in recovery.
Hey, gang, I know you're listening.
Hello. Families of origin are complicated for so many reasons. And a lot of us do have to put up some pretty strong boundaries or completely like let that relationship go, myself included. I have very strong boundaries around my family. And so I'm such I'm a very relational person with my tight group of people, right? Not with everybody, but with my tight group of people. And so it was really important to me to find community where I felt connected in a way that felt like family. And so I have spent a lot of my time, especially in Chicago, building those sorts of very deep connections. And it has been one of the greatest gifts of my life. And I realized along the way that not only am I very relational, I want those close connections. I am generally cuddly as fuck, okay? I want to be touching other humans all the time. And so I naturally am very affectionate with my friends. And so I think I also naturally was drawn to the people who were drawn to that sort of energy. And I've long had thoughts and, you know, read things, especially I've really influenced by Dean Spade, and they have a beautiful essay that includes the idea of treating your friends like lovers and your lovers like mm-hmm. friends when it comes to your level of commitment with the people in your life that are not romantic and sexual partners, and how we want to not only commit but intertwine lives with those mm-hmm. people. So I've been influenced by that for a long time and have started exploring in different relationships over the past few years, what does it mean to have a physically intimate relationship with a purely platonic friend? And that looks different in every relationship. Or what does it look like to truly commit to a friendship in a family sort of way where, you know, you show up for their kids. You are the one who gets called if they need help because they're out of town and their roof is leaking. Like, what are the ways that we can intentionally create commitment and family and intertwining of lives that doesn't rely on just sexual and romantic connections?
That's really powerful. And I have so many questions. First of all, like, I think it's also, and interestingly, I think it's this one kind of hits close to home, because I think also the idea of having kind of familial relationships mean there is actually a lot more room for friction.
Yeah. Like,
there can be, you have to learn how to navigate conflict in a way that might be different from kind of traditional, like, you know, cookie cutter. I don't even know the right word. Like, it's, I want to say heteronormative, but that's not it. But like, yeah, normative, quote unquote, friendships, where it's like if somebody does something wrong and you're mad at them, you just kind of like ice them out, or the friendship's over, or like this kind mm-hmm. of stuff, as opposed to like working through conflict like you might with, you know, a romantic or sexual relationship. But also like kind of how, I mean, it sounds like you had to make a lot of strong boundaries with your family of origin. And I wonder kind of, how did you start to know what the family that you wanted it to feel like? Like when you talk about like, I like friendships that feel like family, I like community that feels like family. How did you start to know what that felt like if it didn't feel like that at home?
Ooh, that's such a juicy question. Let me think about that for a second. I think a lot of it was a slow process of figuring out from my gut, how I wanted to feel around people. So not only romantic or sexual partners, but friendships. Because I think I had these really great, a couple of really great relationships when I was a teenager, one with the guy that I eventually married, and the other with my best friend, who were very much a trio. And I knew what secure attachment felt like from them. And I knew what it felt like from them to be seen for who I was, to be able to relax around somebody, to be able to have a disagreement or a fight and talk it through. And I think I also had those secure relationships with a lot of my college friends, where we were able to go deep with each other and really show up for each other. And so a lot of that knowledge came from maybe letting myself be vulnerable with the people who I was building trust with. And I think along the way, I also probably had, I'm trying to think back on specifics, other relationships that did not feel the way that I wanted them to. And I think maybe not super consciously, I started noticing, you know, who are the people that I feel so drawn to, that I feel safe with, and that have are creating a track record of trust and consistency and safety? And who are the people that I start to feel tense about, that I start to feel like I am observing myself and need to show up a particular way in order to
self-consciousness.
Self-conscious, yeah. And I think that just built in these kind of tiny steps sort of ways. I also, and this is maybe an interesting part of this that I'm still trying to figure out some words around, but I have very, very strong visceral reactions to people, often immediately. So some of my best friends now are people who literally just walked into a room and my gut was like, you, that it's person, you. It's you. Sort of like in a knowing them sort of way. There was something about the way that they showed up that I'm like, ooh, I want to know that person. And I think one of the things that I am learning about that is that they are the people that I consider to be magic. And we can get into this a little bit more. But this idea of I can tell just from the way they show up with very little words said that they feel comfortable in their own skin, that they are being authentic, that they are worn, that they have a presence, that there's some passion there for them. And I feel very drawn to those human beings. And I've also developed a practice over the last few years of just being straight up, because adults don't do this enough, of when I meet one of those people, being like, hey, I like you. Would you like to be friends?
I love that. Yeah. I mean, it's so it's so vulnerable.
It is.
But like, what a cool and brave choice. Like, cut the bullshit. Let's fucking be friends.
Yeah. Exactly.
And like, has the response, I'm like assuming the response has been good if you keep doing
it. Yeah, it has. I think in most cases, it's been a like full body yes for them too. And they've appreciated that I've just come right out and been like, let's be friends. So that I think has felt good for everybody. I'm sure there's some people in there that I'm not remembering that I said it to who were like, yeah. And then it didn't happen. But
slipped away quietly.
That's also fine. Yes.
I mean, and I love the full body yes. Yeah. Cause I think that's kind of what we're looking for here. And also to like learn to honor the subtle no of like, well, what's that about? But I wonder too, like you talk about kind of like appreciating and seeking like not the physical intimate, like cuddly, my friend Mumu, friend of show, refers to it as cozy, like cozy coziness nonstop. Yes. And how do you, I wonder how you kind of like go about seeking that or like seeing what it feels like with non-romantic or non-sexual partners, especially because like, is there any ambiguity because you talk about polyamory and like how do you like keep people that you want to be cozy but not sexual with from getting the wrong idea or being freaked out?
Oh, such a good question there too. A lot of it, and this is maybe an annoying answer, but it's around just communication.
Love. Right?
It's saying, hey, I want to be friends. Or I think testing out the waters a little bit too. Like we all know like the elbow touch or the like hug, and you can feel when someone wants to hug and stay hugging and when they don't. I think I'm also drawn to people who are naturally pretty affectionate. So it's kind of this mutual, very easy, very natural sort of like, I'll touch you on the arm when we talk, or we'll sit close and our knees touch. Or as we get to know each other and that trust builds, I just think it happens super naturally, which is like not a very good answer, maybe.
But it is though, because I do think that like, I have a lot of like only child anxiety. Uh-huh. Where I'm just like, oh God, what does this mean? But like, I do find that often when people like, they're not, that it's always like, if in a consensual way, like a friend is just like, won't let go and we're hugging, I'm like, oh, well, actually this is nice. Yeah. But I kind of have to be forced into it. Like my initial response is like, that's enough. And so that I like the idea of it's like you communicate around it like adults. Because this is not a common practice, I feel, or it's like not necessarily uncommon, but like definitely a learned thing to kind of like move through the discomfort of, again, vulnerable communication.
Absolutely. And I think some of it, like you're saying, is just straight up being like, hey, I am, you know, I've had a long week. Would you be down to come over and have like a cozy, cuddly movie night?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Or stuff like that, that you're just very upfront with, like, hey, I feel comfortable around you. Hey, I want to be your friend. How would you feel about getting cozy and, you know, watching something on the TV? And that way you're just, like, it's
put
just straight
my feet
up consent.
In your lap so you can rub them.
Exactly.
This is a love language.
Yeah, 100%.
And so to kind of return to the parallels of like 12-step recovery and gender magic, because I think there's a lot of, and you mentioned that you wanted to like circle back to the idea of like being magic, which I really appreciate. You know, in 12-step programs, there's this concept of like being restored to sanity. Mm-hmm. But often that's kind of a point that like, that's like a spiritual restoration to sanity. It's not like, I know what sanity feels like because I've been there before. Yeah. Cause a lot of us don't, like, that's a moving target. And I imagine the process of seeking and growing towards gender magic or euphoria might have a similar kind of track, that it's like you don't know until you feel it, right? That you're kind of moving into a space that is, as we mentioned, like a journey that's constantly growing. And I'm curious as to like, what are some of the tools that you suggest or that you have experienced as being helpful in that, the getting on to that path?
Yeah. I do think that there are a ton of parallels here in that concept of returning to sanity. And I also, as you're talking, it reminds me of the concept of resilience. Mm-hmm. And one of the definitions of resilience is that you are returning to what has been compressed, bent, or stretched.
Ooh.
And yeah, right? I love that definition because we often think of resilience, or, and I'm going to parallel it with sanity here, of, oh, we've got to strive towards this thing. It's something that we're not familiar with, so we have to gain it.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the idea of, we're not striving towards it, we are returning. So there is, yes, maybe we've never felt it completely because of our life experiences, because of the environment that we're in, but that knowledge is intrinsic. It is in there. Mm. It is about peeling away and returning. And so I like to start from that place of, you already know, you're just rediscovering. You're just returning.
And the shoe analogy tracks, right? Like this, the shoe's too small. It's like, if that's been the kind of space that you've been compressed into, then when you take off the too small shoe, you can actually breathe again. And it's no longer an issue. And I think also, like, again, all of this is a social construct, essentially. Mm-hmm. So it's like out, like stripping away the layers of like kind of messages and noise that you've been, you know, kind of gathering your whole life, and finding curiosity around the true thing that's underneath mm-hmm. that stuff, right?
Exactly.
Practice, what's that? What's that look like?
Well, I think you started with the most important thing, which is curiosity. Because what happens when we are curious is that we are in our prefrontal cortex, the part of our brain that can think, that can make decisions easier, that it is pretty regulated. Curiosity puts us there. And we get curiosity by looking at what we are moving towards versus what we are moving away from. Because if we think about what we are moving away from, whether we're talking about gender, whether we're talking about sobriety or sexuality, that often comes from a place of fear and a place of lack. And that puts us in a pretty specific part of our brain. But if we think about, what is the vision that I have for my life? What is it that I want, or think that I want, or I'm curious of, even just that, about wanting, it puts us in a very different mindset where we are able to think better, make decisions better. Mm. So I think that is a beautiful foundation to start with. From there, things like curiosity and joy and sanity and pleasure, those are all muscles that we get to build. So if we're used to looking at all the things that are going wrong, all the reasons that we feel terrible in our body, mm-hmm. all the things that are dysphoric or our struggle, it's going to be a little bit harder to discover what are the things that bring us joy and curiosity and pleasure. So we can't ignore the hard things, but I do ask that people put an equal amount of attention on how do we start noticing within ourselves what pleasure feels like, what sanity feels like, what joy, what gender euphoria feels like. And these are often in tiny, tiny moments, which is great news, right? It doesn't have to be a giant light bulb.
Yeah.
It can be, hey, I recognize that when I wore this particular shirt that I felt better in my body than when I wore this other shirt. It's, hey, my friends who use this pronoun with me around me, I feel a little better than this other pronoun. Something in me lights up when I experience X, when I dance in a crowd of queers where I don't feel like I need to put on anything about gender. Those are the moments that as you start grabbing onto those, you can start building on those and expanding. And I find that to be the easiest way and the most pleasurable way to start exploring these parts of ourselves, whether it be gender, whether it be sexuality, whether it be a new relationship with sobriety or sanity, that focusing on what's good, what feels good is a beautiful litmus test.
For sure. I mean, and also I think you know, we talk about like go where it's warm essentially. And I do think that often, you know, any kind of journey towards, as we keep talking about, like authenticity. And I use that word a lot because I feel like it is kind of a requirement in both senses, right? That living authentically is that this is essentially a queer choice. And so too, like it is the thing that's necessary to stay sober.
Yeah.
And I think kind of what I've noticed and one of the reasons I really wanted to talk to you on this show specifically is because like, especially post COVID when Zoom was able, and I wonder if this is kind of, if you've noticed this in your practice also, but, a lot of people kind of came out of that experience of being cloistered and kind of invisible, like staying home as coming out, you know, as trans or non-binary. And in recovery, especially, I think, is because we were all on Zoom meetings for a while, it was a very safe place to be like, here are my pronouns, in a way that wouldn't have happened in a physical meeting, because you don't necessarily use your own pronouns in a physical meeting. And that it became kind of a paramount thing that, like, if I'm going to be completely honest with myself, then this is my truth. And so this is the only way forward, you know? I don't know what the question was. But
have I experienced that?
Yeah, or have you noticed that in your practice of like kind of, you know, although it was a terrible experience of surviving a pandemic and, you know, everything that came with that, that this is actually one area that was maybe revolutionary in a positive way.
I completely agree. And yes, I did see a lot of that both in my practice and personally. You know, I think like you're saying, Zoom created this atmosphere where, for the most part, a lot of people could turn their camera off. They could very easily put their pronouns into Zoom in a low-key way. A lot of the noise of being out in the world, going to the office, even, you know, our friends or who we're surrounded with was just taken away. And I think the silence for a lot of people was deafening and also very generative. You know, I had many clients who started doing more experimentation with how they presented, who had the space both in their brain and in their life to start playing with gender in a new way in a way that it is not going to get noticed at the office in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was really revolutionary for a lot of people. And even myself, like I decided to get top surgery during the pandemic, and it did make that decision easier because all the other noise was taken away. I could work from home. I didn't have to go anywhere. There's nowhere to be. And so that was also pretty revolutionary for me. When things got quiet, it got a lot more clear.
Yeah. And again, I think the whole, you know, the social mirror being often very challenging for this kind of work, just because it's like, I can't tell what is mine and what is what I receive as other people projecting onto me that I feel like I have to live into. Right. So like kind of having that conveniently taken away for a couple of years is, you know, an opportunity for liberation.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And of course it was terrible, and not everybody had the privilege of feeling safe in their home to do that, or even working from home. But for those who did, I do think it was a really, really generative experience in a lot of ways.
Indeed. And I'm curious, kind of speaking of generative experiences, like, you know, where are you growing today?
Ooh, also a really good question.
Try.
I'm a chronic overworker. You know, I mentioned I have 1,000 placements in Capricorn, and have, you know, I'm an entrepreneur and I run a company and I wrote a book and all the things. So one of the ways that I'm growing is learning how to slow down and rest. And I haven't figured it out yet, but I'm working on it. And it is something that I'm interested in developing and figuring out, how can I have my professional life and the things that I want to do and create the things that I want to create in a way that also centers ease and flow.
Hmm.
And right now I don't have all the answers to that, or even the majority of the answers to that, but I do know it's a question that I'm asking myself and that I am open to receiving answers about, like in my gut, internally from others. It is something I'm now attuned to, that I'm trying to figure out what the Ray 3.0 is. I don't quite know yet.
Can I ask kind of what's coming up as you explore explore the concept of ease?
Well, that I'm bad at it, first of all.
It's uncomfortable.
It's not comfortable. I'm noticing all the stuff that comes up around feeling lazy, mm-hmm. around the guilt that I experience when I'm not being productive.
Like capitalism, baby.
I know. And as an entrepreneur, there's always something else that I could be doing, that I could be improving on, that needs attention. So I could work 24 hours a day if I wanted to and still probably not get everything done. So learning how to put the to-do list down and let it go, and understanding that I can only do so much. I am only one human. Even with a great team, I'm still only one human, and I just can't do everything. So kind of noticing that, figuring out, how do I turn my brain off? The paint by numbers with an audiobook and a glass of wine, like that was pretty helpful. I liked that. Or noticing that I can stare at a fire in my backyard or while camping for hours with very little thought in my head. Like trying to take my own advice and notice, what are the moments that I feel content, that I feel still, that I don't feel like my little monkey mind is going everywhere all at once, treadmilling, and how do I build more of that into my week, into my day?
Awesome. I really like how you talk about kind of, it's the noticing the tiny moments where that exists and kind of build, like observing the sensation and kind of building in that direction, as opposed to being like, well, I guess I'll just do nothing and suffer through that.
Yeah. And sometimes it is about doing nothing and suffering through it a little bit to build the practice of like, okay, I cannot feel great while I'm doing nothing, and it's still okay. Like nothing has blown up. I am fine. And maybe the next time it is a little bit less suffering, and maybe even I enjoy it just a little bit.
Maybe there's some good ideas that come that the workaholic can like enjoy after the fact. Like boredom does generate, you know. So we wind down this thrilling hour of conversation with a lightning round, which is just kind of like very low key. It's exclusively for fun. So what is your favorite snack?
Cheese of any kind.
Perfect. Yeah. What does delight feel like in your body?
It feels expansive. It feels like my chest is opening up, and I feel lighter and kind of giddy.
I like how well you know that. That makes me really happy. I feel delighted.
In a practice.
Mine feels like fireworks or like sparkling water, like effervescent, like bubbles.
I love that.
What turns you on? And it can be like sexually or intellectually or creatively, or what kind of what jazzes you up?
Ooh, so many things. Smart and creative people talking to me about what they're passionate about or showing me something that they do really well always lights me up completely. On other things that turn me on, so many things, right? Lightning round. I'm trying to think real fast.
It's okay. So it's really
late. Okay.
Bang, bang, bang.
Okay, cool.
Slowly.
I love anything to do with sensation play. Like I really like feeling different sensations on my body, both, you know, soft and nice and not so soft and nice. And that juxtaposition is something that feels really yummy and delicious to me.
You're really embodied. It's wild.
It has been a work in progress and a big part of my own work throughout my life. So thank you for saying that. I am proud of that fact.
No, it's really exciting. Like I personally am trying to get more in my body, and it's really nice to talk to somebody who's like, who's there and can talk about what that information, like how it guides your life kind of. So thank you for sharing that with us. What is the best thing you've watched or read or listened to recently?
I have recently been obsessed with The Last of Us. It is such a beautiful story. And if anybody has not seen episode 2, like grab some tissues and just watch it. It's amazing.
Is this the infamous Nick Offerman?
Yes. Perfect. It's so, so good. And then I also just finished In the Dream House. I'm way late to the party, but by Carmen Maria, my brain is blanking on her last name, but queer author In the Dream House. It's a memoir about abuse within a queer relationship, but it is one of the most beautiful books that I have ever read. And I read the entire thing in like a day and a half. I just could not put it down.
Powerful. Okay. Strong recommendations. Yeah. Thank you.
Carmen Maria. And you know, if you're listening to this,
guys,
I'm sorry, I've forgotten your
you
last
know
name.
How to use Google
it. I'll know for next time.
Well, it means we'll have to have you back so you can give us the right Google. What is your favorite way to play?
Ooh, dancing. I love dancing in a sweaty crowd of queers. It is one of the most delightful and joyous things to me ever.
Collective effervescence. Check.
Yep, that's right.
What do you love?
Ooh. I love so many things. Right now I'm staring at my little dog, so I definitely love her. I love that I get to talk about the things professionally that I get to talk about and share ways and inspiration for people to be able to be their most authentic self in the world. I also love design of all kinds. I'm such a nerd about aesthetics and design. And I love, love, love beautiful words, like writers like Lydia Yuknovich or Carmen Maria. So sorry, last name. people like that are just, they light up my soul.
And finally, well, there's one more question, but it's like, how do we find you on the internet? But we'll save that. The last question of the lightning round that we have to do any thinking about is, where are you experiencing gender magic today?
Ooh, I am wearing this great jumpsuit. Listeners, you can't see it, but it's this tie-dyed jumpsuit, and I feel very in my body and good, like I'm having a good hair day. There's a lot that's going well today. So I feel that
the magic is real.
The magic is real. Yeah.
That's cool. I mean, I can see you because we're doing a video chat, obviously. And I thought it was just like kind of like a Hawaiian like dad shirt. And the fact that it's a jumpsuit is like also giving me, I'm receiving your gender.
Wonderful.
Magic, so fantastic. And where can people find you on the internet or otherwise?
Instagram is a hub for me. So you can find me there at The Rae McDaniel. That's Rae, R-A-E. You can check out Gender Magic at gendermagic.com. And you can check out more about my own work at rae-mcdaniel.com. And there's links to all the things in all the places.
Do it, do it, do it, do it. It's also, I mean, I have to say, I'm a big fan of your internet content. So like, go in, listeners. You won't be disappointed. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
Oh my gosh, thank you for having me. This is lovely.
Indeed. And again, like if you've ever had anything that you want to plug or if you want to talk more about gender magic, we are here for it. It's a delight.
Anytime. Seriously, a delightful conversation. I'd love to come back. So let's make that happen.
Fucking rad. It's like, I'm stopping the recording.
Creativity, authenticity, body autonomy, mental health, sexuality, gender identity, recovery, gotta special growth.